straight at my face, whatever it takes. The bloodlust was palpable and understandable. Andy Card asked if I wanted to say something to the crowd. I decided I should. There was no stage, no microphone, and no prepared remarks. Andy pointed me to a mound of metal. I looked at Secret Service Agent Carl Truscott, who nodded that it was safe to climb up. An older firefighter was standing atop the pile. I put out my hand and he pulled me up next to him. His name was Bob Beckwith. Nina Bishop, a member of the advance team, had tracked down a bullhorn that I could use to address those assembled. She thrust it into my hands. The crowd was able to see me atop the mound, which I later learned was a crumpled fire truck. My first instinct was to console. I told them that America was on bended knee in prayer for the victims, the rescuers, and the families. People shouted, "We can't hear you." I shot back, "I can hear you." It got a cheer. I had been hoping to rally the workers and express the resolve of the country. Suddenly I knew how. "I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you," I said, prompting a louder roar. "And the people who knock these buildings down will hear all of us soon." The crowd exploded. It was a release of energy I had never felt before. They struck up a chant of USA, USA, USA. I had spent a fair amount of time in New York over the years, but it wasn't until September 14, 2001, that I got a sense of the city's real character. After the visit to Ground Zero, we drove 3 miles north to the Javits Center. I was amazed by the number of people on the West Side Highway waving flags and cheering. "I hate to break it to you, Mr. President," Rudy joked, "but none of these people voted for you." At the Javits Center, I walked into a staging area for first responders from across the country. I greeted firemen and rescuers from states as far away as Ohio and California. Without being asked, they had come to the city to serve as reinforcements. I thanked them on behalf of the nation and urged them to continue their good work. The building's parking garage had been converted into a gathering place for about 200 family members of missing first responders. The people in the room spanned all ages, from elderly grandmothers to newborn babies. Many were living the same nightmare. Their loved ones had last been seen or heard near the World Trade Center. They wanted to know if they had survived. I had just seen the debris of the towers. I knew it would be a miracle if anyone emerged. Yet the families refused to give up hope. We prayed together and wept together. Many people asked for pictures or autographs. I felt awkward signing autographs in a time of grief, but I wanted to do anything I could to ease their pain. I asked each family to tell me a little bit about their missing loved one. Then I said, "I'll sign this card. And then when your dad or mom or son or daughter comes home, they'll believe that you really met the president." As I came to the last corner of the room, I saw a family gathered around a seated woman. I sat down next to the woman, who told me her name was Arlene Howard. Her son was a Port Authority police officer who'd had September 11th off but volunteered to help as soon as he heard about the attacks. He had last been seen rushing into the dust and smoke 3 days earlier. As I was getting ready to say goodbye, Arlene reached into her purse and held out her hand. It contained a metal object. "This is my son's badge. His name is George Howard. Please remember him," she said, as she pressed the badge into my hand. I promised I would. I served 2,685 days as president after Arlene gave me that badge. I kept it with me every one of them. As the years passed, most Americans returned to life as usual. That was natural and desirable. It meant the country was healing and people felt safer. As I record these thoughts, that day of fire is a distant memory for some of our citizens. The youngest Americans have no first-hand knowledge of the day. Eventually, September 11th will come to feel more like Pearl Harbor Day, an honored date on the calendar and an important moment in history, but not a scar on the heart, not a reason to fight on. For me, The week of September 11th will always be something more. I still see the Pentagon smoldering, the towers in flames, and that pile of twisted steel. I still hear the voices of the loved ones searching for survivors, and the workers yelling, "Do not let me down," and "Whatever it takes." I still feel the sadness of the children, the agony of the burn victims, and the torment of the broken families. I still marvel at the bravery of the firefighters and the compassion of strangers and the matchless courage of the passengers who forced down that plane. September 11th redefined sacrifice. It redefined duty, and it redefined my job. The story of that week is the key to understanding my presidency. There were so many decisions that followed, many of them controversial and complex. Yet after 9/11, I felt my responsibility was clear. For as long as I held office, I could never forget what happened to America that day. I would pour my heart and soul into protecting the country, whatever it took. Chapter 6 War Footing. On October 17, 2001, I boarded Air Force One for my first trip out of the country since 9/11. We were headed to Shanghai for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit, a gathering of 21 leaders from Pacific Rim nations. The Secret Service was anxious about the trip. For weeks, we had received chilling intelligence reports about potential follow-up attacks. Yet strengthening America's relationships in the Far East was one of my top priorities, and I wanted my fellow world leaders to see firsthand my determination to battle the terrorists. As Air Force One touched down at the Shanghai airport, I thought back to the dusty, bicycle-filled city I had visited with Mother in 1975. This time, we made the 45-minute drive to downtown Shanghai on a modern highway. We sped past a sparkling new section of the city called Pudong. I later learned the government had moved roughly 100,000 people off the land to enable the construction. The skyscrapers and neon lights reminded me of Las Vegas. For Shanghai, the great leap forward had finally arrived. The next morning, I squeezed into a blue tent at the Ritz-Carlton with Colin Powell, Condi Rice, Andy Card, and the CIA briefer. The structure was designed to protect the national security briefing from potential eavesdroppers. We turned on a video monitor, and Dick Cheney's face popped up from New York City. He was wearing white tie and tails for his speech at the Alfred E. Smith Memorial Foundation Dinner, an annual charity event organized by the Catholic Archdiocese. As soon as I saw Dick, I could tell something was wrong. His face was as white as his tie. "Mr. President," he said. "One of the biodetectors went off at the White House. They found traces of botulinum toxin. The chances are we've all been exposed." The CIA had briefed me on botulinum toxin. It was one of the world's most poisonous substances. Nobody said a word. Finally, Cullen asked, "What's the time of exposure?" Was he doing the mental math, trying to figure out how long it had been since he was last in the White House? Deputy National Security Advisor Steve Hadley explained that the FBI was testing the suspicious substance on mice. The next 24 hours would be crucial. If the mice were still scurrying around, feet down, we would be fine. But if the mice were on their backs, feet up, we were goners. Condi tried to lighten the mood. "Well," she said, "this is one way to die for your country." I went to the summit meetings and awaited the test results. The next day, Condi got a message that Steve was trying to reach her. "I guess this is the call," she said. After a few minutes, Condi came back with the news. "Feet down, not feet up," she said. It was a false alarm. Years later, incidents like the botulinum toxin scare can seem fanciful and far-fetched. It's easy to chuckle at the image of America's most senior officials praying for lab mice to stay upright. But at the time, the threats were urgent, and real. 6 mornings a week, George Tenet and the CIA briefed me on what they called the threat matrix, a summary of potential attacks on the homeland. On Sundays, I received a written intelligence briefing. Between 9/11 and mid-2003, the CIA reported to me on an average of 400 specific threats each month. The CIA tracked more than 20 separate alleged large-scale attack plots, ranging from possible chemical and biological weapons operations in Europe to potential homeland attacks involving sleeper operatives. Some reports mentioned specific targets, including major landmarks, military bases, universities, and shopping malls. For months after 9/11, I would wake up in the middle of the night worried about what I had read. I peppered my briefers with questions. How credible was each threat? What had we done to follow up on a lead? Each piece of information was like a tile in a mosaic. In late September, FBI Director Bob Mueller inserted a big tile when he told me there were 331 potential Al-Qaeda operatives inside the United States. The overall image was unmistakable. The prospect of a second wave of terrorist attacks against America was very real. Prior to 9/11, many had viewed terrorism primarily as a crime to be prosecuted, as the government had after the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993. After 9/11, it was clear that the attacks on our embassies in East Africa and on the USS Cole were more than isolated crimes. They were a warm-up for September 11th, part of a master plan orchestrated by Osama bin Laden, who issued a religious edict known as a fatwa, calling the murder of Americans an individual duty for every Muslim who can do it in any country in which it is possible to do it. On 9/11, it was obvious the law enforcement approach to terrorism had failed. Suicidal men, willing to fly passenger planes into buildings, were not common criminals. They could not be deterred by the threat of prosecution. They had declared war on America. To protect the country, we had to wage war against the terrorists. The war would be different from any America had fought in the past. We had to uncover the terrorist plots. We had to track their movements and disrupt their operations. We had to cut off their money and deprive them of their safe havens. And we had to do it all under the threat of another attack. The terrorists had made their home front a battleground. Putting America on a war footing was one of the most important decisions of my presidency. My authority to conduct the war on terror came from two sources. One was Article 2 of the Constitution, which entrusts the president with wartime powers as commander-in-chief. The other was a congressional war resolution passed 3 days after 9/11. By a vote of 98-0 in the Senate and 420-1 in the House, Congress declared that the president is authorized to use all necessary appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001, or harbored such organizations or persons, in order to prevent any future acts of international terrorism against the United States by such nations, organizations, or persons. In the years ahead, some in Congress would forget those words. I never did. I woke up every morning thinking about the danger we faced and the responsibilities I carried. I was also keenly aware that presidents had a history of overreaching during war. John Adams signed the Alien and Sedition Acts, which banned public dissent. Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War. Franklin Roosevelt ordered Japanese Americans interned during World War II. When I took the oath of office, I swore to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. My most solemn duty, the calling of my presidency, was to protect America within the authority granted to me by the Constitution. The immediate task after 9/11 was to harden our nation's defenses against a second attack. The undertaking was daunting. To stop the enemy, we had to be right 100% of the time. To harm us, they had to succeed only once. We implemented a flurry of new security measures. I approved the deployment of National Guard forces to airports, put more air marshals on planes, required airlines to harden cockpit doors, and tighten the procedures for granting visas and screening passengers. Working with state and local governments and the private sector, we increased security at seaports, bridges, nuclear power plants, and other vulnerable infrastructure. Shortly after 9/11, I appointed Governor Tom Ridge of Pennsylvania to a new senior White House position overseeing our homeland security effort. Tom brought valuable management experience, but by early 2002, it had become clear that the task was too large to be coordinated out of a small White House office. Dozens of different federal agencies shared responsibility for securing the homeland. The patchwork approach was inefficient, and there was too much risk that something would slip through the seams. One egregious example came in March 2002, when the Immigration and Naturalization Service, INS, mailed a letter notifying a Florida flight school that it had granted student visas to Muhammad Atta and Mawan al-Shahi. The person opening the letter must have been shocked. Those were the two pilots who had flown airplanes into the Twin Towers on 9/11. I was shocked, too. As I told the press at the time, I could barely get my coffee down. The sloppy era exemplified the need for broader reform. INS, a branch of the Justice Department, wasn't the only agency struggling with its new homeland security responsibilities. The Customs Service, reporting to the Treasury Department, faced the enormous task of securing the nation's ports. They shared that responsibility with the Coast Guard, which was part of the Transportation Department. Democratic Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut had been making the strong case for creating a new federal department that unified our homeland security efforts. I liked and respected Joe. He was a solid legislator who had put the bitterness of the 2000 election behind him and understood the urgency of the war on terror. Initially, I was wary of his idea for a new department. A big bureaucracy would be cumbersome. I was also anxious about a massive reorganization in the midst of crisis. As J.D. Crouch, later my deputy national security advisor, put it, when you are in the process of beating swords into plowshares, you can't fight and you can't plow. Over time, I changed my mind. I recognized that having one department focused on homeland security would align authority and responsibility. With the agencies accountable for protecting the country under one roof, there would be fewer gaps and less redundancy. I also knew there was a successful precedent for restructuring the government in wartime. At the dawn of the Cold War in 1947, President Harry Truman had consolidated the Navy and War Departments into a new Department of Defense. His reforms strengthened the military for decades to come. I decided the reorganization was worth the risk. In June 2002, I addressed the nation from the White House to call on Congress to create a new Department of Homeland Security. Despite support from many lawmakers, the bill faced rough sledding. Democrats held up the legislation by insisting that the new department grant its employees extensive collective bargaining rights that did not apply in any other government agency. I was frustrated that Democrats would delay an urgent security measure to placate labor unions. Republican candidates took the issue to the voters in the 2002 midterm elections, and I joined them. On election day, our party picked up 6 seats in the House and 2 in the Senate. Karl Rove reminded me that the only other president to pick up seats in both the House and Senate in his first midterm election was Franklin Roosevelt. Within weeks of the election, the Homeland Security Bill passed. I didn't have to search long for my first secretary of the new department. I nominated Tom Ridge. On October 2, 2001, a tabloid photo editor named Bob Stevens was admitted to a Florida hospital with a high fever and vomiting. When doctors examined him, they discovered that he had inhaled a lethal bacteria, anthrax. 3 days later, he was dead. More employees at the tabloid turned up sick, along with people who opened the mail at NBC, ABC, and CBS News. Envelopes laced with white powder arrived at the Senate office of Tom Daschle. Several Capitol Hill staffers and postal workers got sick. So did a New York City hospital worker and a 94-year-old woman in Connecticut. Ultimately, 17 people were infected. Tragically, 5 died. One of the letters containing anthrax read, 09-11-01. You cannot stop us. We have this anthrax. You die now. Are you afraid? Death to America. Death to Israel. Allah is great. I was struck by a sickening thought. Was this the second wave? A biological attack? I had been briefed on the horrifying consequences of a bioweapons attack. One assessment concluded that a well-executed smallpox attack by a state actor on the New York City metropolitan area could infect 630,000 people immediately and 2 to 3 million people before the outbreak was contained. Another scenario contemplated the release of bioweapons on subway lines in 4 major cities during rush hour. Some 200,000 could be infected initially, with 1 million victims overall. The economic cost could range from $60 billion to several hundred billion dollars or more, depending on the circumstances of the attack. As the anthrax news broke, panic spread across the country. Millions of Americans were afraid to open their mailboxes. Office mailrooms shut down. Mothers rushed to the hospital to order anthrax tests for children suffering from a common cold. Deranged hoaxers mailed packages laced with talcum powder or flour, which exacerbated people's fears. The Postal Service tested samples of mail for anthrax at more than 200 sites across the country. Mail at the White House was rerouted and irradiated for the rest of my presidency. Thousands of government personnel, including Laura and me, were advised to take Cipro, a powerful antibiotic. The biggest question during the anthrax attack was where it was coming from. One of the best intelligence services in Europe told us it suspected Iraq. Saddam Hussein's regime was one of few in the world with a record of using weapons of mass destruction, and it had acknowledged possession of anthrax in 1995. Others suspected that Al-Qaeda was involved. Frustratingly, we had no concrete evidence and few good leads. In 2010, after an exhaustive investigation, the Justice Department and FBI concluded that Dr. Bruce Ivins, a U.S. government scientist who committed suicide in 2008, had executed the anthrax attack alone. 1 month after 9/11, I held a primetime televised press conference from the White House. Earlier that day, we had raised the terror alert level in response to reports about a senior Taliban official warning of another major attack on America. You talk about the general threat toward Americans, Ann Compton of ABC News said. What are Americans supposed to look for? A CIA briefing on the threat of terrorists spraying anthrax over a city from a small plane was fresh in my mind. Ann, I said, if you find a person that you've never seen before getting in a crop duster that doesn't belong to him, report it. My line got a laugh, but behind the humor was a maddening reality. We believed more attacks were coming, but we didn't know when, where, or from whom. Striking the right balance between alerting and alarming the public remained a challenge for the rest of the administration. As time passed, some critics charged that we inflated the threat or manipulated alert levels for political benefit. They were flat wrong. We took the intelligence seriously and did the best we could to keep the American people informed and safe. This is the worst we've seen since 9/11. George Tenet said in a grave voice as he pulled out his half-chewed cigar at a late October intelligence briefing. He cited a highly reliable source warning that there would be an attack on either October 30th or 31st that was bigger than the World Trade Center attack. After several false alarms, we believe this could be the real deal. Dick Cheney and I agreed that he should move to a safe place outside Washington, the famous undisclosed location, to ensure continuity of government. The Secret Service recommended that I leave too. I told them I was staying put. Maybe this was a little bravado on my part. Mostly it was fatalism. I had made my peace. If it was God's will that I die in the White House, I would accept it. Laura felt the same way. We were confident the government would survive an attack, even if we didn't. I did have one good reason to leave Washington for a few hours. The New York Yankees had invited me to throw out the first pitch at Game 3 of the World Series. 7 weeks after 9/11, it would send a powerful signal for the president to show up in Yankee Stadium. I hoped my visit would help lift the spirits of New Yorkers. We flew to New York on Air Force One and choppered into a field next to the ballpark. I went to a batting cage to loosen up my arm. A Secret Service agent strapped a bulletproof vest to my chest. After a few warm-up pitches, the great Yankee shortstop Derek Jeter dropped in to take some swings. We talked a little. Then he asked, "Hey, President, are you going to throw from the mound or from in front of it?" I asked what he thought. "Throw from the mound," Derek said, "or else they'll boo you." I agreed to do it. On his way out, he looked over his shoulder and said, "But don't bounce it. They'll boo you." 9 months into the presidency, I was used to being introduced to a crowd. But I'd never had a feeling like I did when Bob Shepard, the Yankees' legendary public address announcer, belted out, "Please welcome the President of the United States." I climbed the mound, gave a wave and a thumbs up, and peered in at the catcher, Todd Green. He looked a lot farther away than 60 feet 6 inches. My adrenaline was surging. The ball felt like a shot put. I wound up and let it fly. The noise in the stadium was like a sonic boom. "USA! USA! USA!" I thought back to the workers at Ground Zero. I shook hands with Todd Green, posed for a photo with the managers, Joe Torre of the Yankees and Bob Brenly of the Arizona Diamondbacks, and made my way to George Steinbrenner's box. I was the definition of a relieved pitcher. I was thrilled to see Laura and our daughter Barbara. She gave me a big hug and said, "Dad, you threw a strike." We flew back to Washington late that night and waited out the next day. October 31st passed without an attack. Putting the country on a war footing required more than just tightening our physical defenses. We needed better legal, financial, and intelligence tools to find the terrorists and stop them before it was too late. One major gap in our counterterrorism capabilities was what many called the wall. Over time, the government had adopted a set of procedures that prevented law enforcement and intelligence personnel from sharing key information. How can we possibly assure our citizens we are protecting them if our own people can't even talk to each other? I said in one meeting shortly after the attacks. We've got to fix the problem. Attorney General John Ashcroft took the lead in writing a legislative proposal. The result was the USA Patriot Act. Congress named the law the Uniting and Strengthening America by providing appropriate tools required to intercept and obstruct terrorism act. The bill eliminated the wall and allowed law enforcement and intelligence personnel to share information. It modernized our counterterrorism capabilities by giving investigators access to tools like roving wiretaps, which allowed them to track suspects who changed cell phone numbers, an authority that had long been used to catch drug traffickers and mob bosses. It authorized aggressive financial measures to freeze terrorist assets, and it included judicial and congressional oversight to protect civil liberties. One provision created a little discomfort at home. The Patriot Act allowed the government to seek warrants to examine the business records of suspected terrorists, such as credit card receipts, apartment leases, and library records. As a former librarian, Laura didn't like the idea of federal agents snooping around libraries. I didn't either. But the intelligence community had serious concerns about terrorists using library computers to communicate. Library records had played a role in several high-profile cases, such as the Zodiac gunman murders in California. The last thing I wanted was to allow the freedom and access to information provided by American libraries to be utilized against us by Al-Qaeda. Lawmakers recognized the urgency of the threat and passed the Patriot Act 98-1 in the Senate and 357-66 in the House. I signed the bill into law on October 26, 2001. We took time to look at it. We took time to read it, and we took time to remove those parts that were unconstitutional and those parts that would have actually hurt liberties of all Americans. Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont said. His Democratic colleague, Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, added, "If there is one key word that underscores this bill, it is balance. In the new post-September 11th society that we face, balance is going to be a key word. Balance and reason have prevailed." Over the next 5 years, the Patriot Act helped us break up potential terror cells in New York, Oregon, Virginia, and Florida. In one example, law enforcement and intelligence authorities shared information that led to the arrest of 6 Yemeni Americans in Lackawanna, New York, who had traveled to a terrorist training camp in Afghanistan and met with Osama bin Laden. 5 pled guilty to providing material support to Al-Qaeda. The other admitted to unlawful transactions with Al-Qaeda. Some claim the Lackawanna 6 and others we arrested were little more than small-town dupes with fanciful plots who had no intention of carrying out terrorist acts. I always wondered how the second-guessers could be so sure. After all, in August 2001, the idea that terrorists commanded from caves in Afghanistan would attack the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on U.S. commercial airplanes would have seemed pretty far-fetched. For me, the lesson of 9/11 was simple. Don't take chances. When our law enforcement and intelligence professionals found people with ties to terrorist networks inside the United States, I would rather be criticized for taking them into custody too early than waiting until it was too late. As the freshness of 9/11 faded, so did the overwhelming congressional support for the Patriot Act. Civil liberties advocates and commentators on the wings of both parties mischaracterized the law as a stand-in for everything they disliked about the war on terror. Key provisions of the Patriot Act, such as the authority to conduct roving wiretaps, were set to expire in 2005. I pushed hard for their reauthorization. As I told Congress, the threat had not expired, so the law shouldn't either. Lawmakers delayed and complained. But when they finally held a vote, they renewed the Patriot Act by a margin of 89-10 in the Senate and 251-174 in the House. In early 2010, key provisions of the Patriot Act were authorized again by the heavily Democratic Congress. My one regret about the Patriot Act is its name. When my administration sent the bill to Capitol Hill, it was initially called the Anti-Terrorism Act of 2001. Congress got clever and renamed it. As a result, there was an implication that people who opposed the law were unpatriotic. That was not what I intended. I should have pushed Congress to change the name of the bill before I signed it. As part of the 9/11 investigation, we discovered that 2 hijackers who had infiltrated the United States, Khalid al-Madar and Nawaf al-Hazmi, had communicated with al-Qaeda leaders overseas more than a dozen times before the attack. My immediate question was, why hadn't we intercepted the calls? If we had heard what Madar and Hazmi were saying, we might have been able to stop the attacks of 9/11. The man with the answers was Mike Hayden, the 3-star Air Force general who led the National Security Agency. If the intelligence community is the brains of national security, The NSA is part of the gray matter. The agency is filled with smart, techno-savvy experts and code breakers, along with analysts and linguists. Mike told me the NSA had the capability to monitor those Al-Qaeda phone calls into the United States before 9/11. But he didn't have the legal authority to do it without receiving a court order, a process that could be difficult and slow. The reason was a law called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Written in 1978 before widespread use of cell phones and the internet, FISA prohibited the NSA from monitoring communications involving people inside the United States without a warrant from the FISA court. For example, if a terrorist in Afghanistan contacted a terrorist in Pakistan, NSA could intercept their conversation. But if the same terrorist called someone in the United States or sent an email that touched an American computer server, NSA had to apply for a court order. That made no sense. Why should it be tougher to monitor Al-Qaeda communications with terrorists inside the United States than with their associates overseas? As Mike Hayden put it, we were flying blind with no early warning system. After 9/11, we couldn't afford to fly blind. If Al-Qaeda operatives were calling into or out of the United States, we damn sure needed to know who they were calling and what they were saying. And given the urgency of the threats, we could not allow ourselves to get bogged down in the court approval process. I asked the White House Counsel's Office and the Justice Department to study whether I could authorize the NSA to monitor Al-Qaeda communications into and out of the country without FISA warrants. Both told me I could. They concluded that conducting surveillance against our enemies in war fell within the authorities granted by the Congressional War Resolution and the constitutional authority of the Commander-in-Chief. Abraham Lincoln had wiretapped telegraph machines during the Civil War. Woodrow Wilson had ordered the interception of virtually every telephone and telegraph message going into or out of the United States during World War I. Franklin Roosevelt had allowed the military to read and censor communications during World War II. Before I approved the terrorist surveillance program, I wanted to ensure that there were safeguards to prevent abuses. I had no desire to turn the NSA into an Orwellian Big Brother. I knew that the Kennedy brothers had teamed up with J. Edgar Hoover to listen illegally to the conversations of innocent people, including Martin Luther King Jr. Lyndon Johnson had continued the practice. I thought that was a sad chapter in our history, and I wasn't going to repeat it. On the morning of October 4th, 2001, Mike Hayden and the legal team came to the Oval Office. They assured me the terrorist surveillance program had been carefully designed to protect the civil liberties of innocent people. The purpose of the program was to monitor so-called dirty numbers, which intelligence professionals had reason to believe belonged to Al-Qaeda operatives. Many had been found in the cell phones or computers of terrorists captured on the battlefield. If we inadvertently intercepted any portion of purely domestic communications, the violation would be reported to the Justice Department for investigation. To be sure the program was used only as long as necessary, it had to be regularly reassessed and reapproved. I gave the order to proceed with the program. We considered going to Congress to get legislation, but key members from both parties who received highly classified briefings on the program agreed that the surveillance was necessary and that a legislative debate was not possible without exposing our methods to the enemy. I knew the terrorist surveillance program would prove controversial one day, yet I believed it was necessary. The rubble at the World Trade Center was still smoldering. Every morning I received intelligence reports about another possible attack. Monitoring terrorist communications into the United States was essential to keeping the American people safe. On December 22nd, a British passenger named Richard Reed tried to blow up an American Airlines flight carrying 197 people from Paris to Miami by detonating explosives in his shoes. Fortunately, an alert flight attendant noticed his suspicious behavior, and passengers overwhelmed him before he could light the fuse. The plane was diverted to Boston, where Reed was marched off in handcuffs. He later told questioners that his goal was to cripple the U.S. economy with an attack during the holiday season. He pled guilty to 8 counts of terrorist activity, leading to a life sentence at the federal Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. The foiled attack had a big impact on me. 3 months after 9/11, it was a vivid reminder that the threats were frighteningly real. Airport screeners began requiring passengers to remove their shoes at checkpoints. I recognized that we were creating an inconvenience, but I felt it was worth it to prevent a copycat attack. I knew my policy was being implemented fully when Laura's 82-year-old mom had to take off her shoes before her Christmas flight from Midland to Washington. I sure hoped I wouldn't be nearby if they asked Mother to do the same. The near miss over the Atlantic highlighted a broader gap in our approach to the war on terror. When Richard Reed was arrested, he was swiftly placed into the U.S. criminal justice system, which entitled him to the same constitutional protections as a common criminal. But the shoe bomber was not a burglar or bank robber. He was a foot soldier in Al-Qaeda's war against America. He had emailed his mother 2 days before his attempted attack. "What I am doing is part of the ongoing war between Islam and disbelief." By giving this terrorist the right to remain silent, we deprived ourselves of the opportunity to collect vital intelligence on his plan and his handlers. Reed's case made clear we needed a new policy for dealing with captured terrorists. In this new kind of war, there is no more valuable source of intelligence on potential attacks than the terrorists themselves. Amid the steady stream of threats after 9/11, I grappled with three of the most critical decisions I would make in the war on terror. Where to hold captured enemy fighters, how to determine their legal status, and ensure they eventually face justice, and how to learn what they knew about future attacks so we could protect the American people. Initially, most captured Al-Qaeda fighters were held for questioning in battlefield prisons in Afghanistan. In November, CIA officers went to interrogate Taliban and Al-Qaeda prisoners detained at a primitive 19th-century Afghan fortress, Qala-i-Jangi. A riot ensued. Using weapons smuggled onto the complex, enemy fighters killed one of our officers, Johnny Mike Spann, making him the first American combat death in the war. The tragedy highlighted the need for a secure facility to hold captured terrorists. There were few options, none particularly attractive. For a while, we held Al-Qaeda detainees on Navy ships in the Arabian Sea, but that was not a viable long-term solution. Another possibility was to send the terrorists to a secure base on a distant island or U.S. territory, such as Guam. But holding captured terrorists on American soil could activate constitutional protections they would not otherwise receive, such as the right to remain silent. That would make it much more difficult to get urgently needed intelligence. We decided to hold detainees at a remote naval station on the southern tip of Cuba, Guantanamo Bay. The base was on Cuban soil, but the United States controlled it, under a lease acquired after the Spanish-American War. The Justice Department advised me that prisoners brought there had no right of access to the U.S. criminal justice system. The area surrounding Guantanamo was inaccessible and sparsely populated. Holding terrorists in Fidel Castro's Cuba was hardly an appealing prospect. But as Don Rumsfeld put it, Guantanamo was the least worst choice available. At Guantanamo, detainees were given clean and safe shelter, 3 meals a day, a personal copy of the Quran, the opportunity to pray 5 times daily, and the same medical care their guards received. They had access to exercise space and a library stocked with books and DVDs. One of the most popular was an Arabic translation of Harry Potter. Over the years, we invited members of Congress, journalists, and international observers to visit Guantanamo and see the conditions for themselves. Many came away surprised by what they found. A Belgian official inspected Guantanamo 5 times and called it a model prison. that offered detainees better treatment than Belgian prisons. I have never witnessed acts of violence or things which shocked me in Guantanamo, he said. One should not confuse this center with Abu Ghraib. While our humane treatment of Guantanamo detainees was consistent with the Geneva Conventions, Al-Qaeda did not meet the qualifications for Geneva protection as a legal matter. The purpose of Geneva was to provide incentives for nation-states to fight wars by an agreed set of rules that protect human dignity and innocent life, and to punish warriors who do not. But the terrorists did not represent a nation-state. They had not signed the Geneva Conventions. Their entire mode of operation, intentionally killing the innocent, defied the principles of Geneva. And if Al-Qaeda captured an American, there was little chance they would treat him humanely. This was confirmed with gruesome clarity in late January 2002, when terrorists in Pakistan abducted Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl. They alleged he was a CIA spy and tried to blackmail the United States into bargaining for his release. America has a long-standing policy of not negotiating with terrorists, and I continued it. I knew that if I accepted one terrorist's demands, it would only encourage more kidnappings. Our military and intelligence assets were searching urgently for Pearl, but they couldn't make it in time. In his final moments, Danny Pearl said, "My father is Jewish, my mother is Jewish, I am Jewish." Then his Al-Qaeda captors slit his throat. As I made my decision on Geneva protection, I also decided to create a legal system to determine the innocence or guilt of detainees. George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, William McKinley, and Franklin Roosevelt had faced similar dilemmas of how to bring captured enemy combatants to justice during wartime. All had reached the same conclusion: a court operated by the military. On November 13, 2001, I signed an executive order establishing military tribunals to try captured terrorists. The system was based closely on the one created by FDR in 1942, which tried and convicted 8 Nazi spies who had infiltrated the United States. The Supreme Court had unanimously upheld the legality of those tribunals. I was confident the military tribunals would provide a fair trial. Detainees were entitled to the presumption of innocence, representation by a qualified attorney, and the right to prevent evidence that would have probative value to a reasonable person. For practical national security reasons, they were not allowed to view classified information that would expose intelligence sources and methods. Convicting a defendant required agreement of 2/3 of the tribunal. The detainee could appeal the tribunal's decision or sentence to the Secretary of Defense and to the President. Inherent in my tribunal's decision, and many others in the new war, was the tension between protecting the American people and upholding civil liberties. Maintaining our values was critical to our position in the world. We could neither lead the free world nor recruit new allies to our cause if we did not practice what we preached. I believed military tribunals struck the right balance, upholding the rule of law while protecting the country. On March 28, 2002, I could hear excitement in George Tenet's voice. He reported that Pakistani police, with a hand from the FBI and CIA, had launched a takedown operation against several Al-Qaeda safe houses in the Pakistani city of Faisalabad. They netted more than 24 operatives, including Abu Zubaydah. I had been hearing reports about Zubaydah for months. The intelligence community believed he was a trusted associate of Osama bin Laden and a senior recruiter and operator who had run a camp in Afghanistan where some of the 9/11 hijackers had trained. He was suspected of involvement in previous plots to destroy targets in Jordan and blow up Los Angeles International Airport. The CIA believed he was planning to attack America again. Zubaydah had been severely wounded in a gun battle prior to his arrest. The CIA flew in a top doctor who saved his life. The Pakistanis then turned him over to our custody. The FBI began questioning Zubeidah, who had clearly been trained on how to resist interrogation. He revealed bits and pieces of information that he thought we already knew. Frighteningly, we didn't know much. For example, we received definitive information about a new alias for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who Zubeidah also confirmed had masterminded the 9/11 attacks. Then Zubeidah stopped answering questions. George Tenet told me interrogators believed Zubeidah had more information to reveal. If he was hiding something more, what could it be? Zubeidah was our best lead to avoid another catastrophic attack. We need to find out what he knows, I directed the team. What are our options? One option was for the CIA to take over Zubeidah's questioning and move him to a secure location in another country where the agency could have total control over his environment. CIA experts drew up a list of interrogation techniques that differed from those Zubeidah had successfully resisted. George assured me all interrogations would be performed by experienced intelligence professionals who had undergone extensive training. Medical personnel would be on site to guarantee that the detainee was not physically or mentally harmed. At my direction, Department of Justice and CIA lawyers conducted a careful legal review. They concluded that the enhanced interrogation program complied with the Constitution and all applicable laws, including those that ban torture. I took a look at the list of techniques. There were two that I felt went too far, even if they were legal. I directed the CIA not to use them. Another technique was waterboarding, a process of simulated drowning. No doubt the procedure was tough, but medical experts assured the CIA that it did no lasting harm. I knew that an interrogation program this sensitive and controversial would one day become public. When it did, we would open ourselves up to criticism that America had compromised our moral values. I would have preferred that we get the information another way, but the choice between security and values was real. Had I not authorized waterboarding on senior Al-Qaeda leaders, I would have had to accept a greater risk that the country would be attacked. In the wake of 9/11, that was a risk I was unwilling to take. My most solemn responsibility as president was to protect the country. I approved the use of the interrogation techniques. The new techniques proved highly effective. Zubeidah revealed large amounts of information on Al-Qaeda's structure and operations. He also provided leads that helped reveal the location of Ramzi bin al-Shib, the logistical planner of the 9/11 attacks. The Pakistani police picked him up on the first anniversary of 9/11. Zubeidah later explained to interrogators why he started answering questions again. His understanding of Islam was that he had to resist interrogation only up to a certain point. Waterboarding was the technique that allowed him to reach that threshold, fulfill his religious duty, and then cooperate. "You must do this for all the brothers," he said. On March 1, 2003, George Tenet told a spy story suitable for a John le Carré novel. Information gleaned through the interrogations of Abu Zubeidah and Ramzi bin al-Shib, combined with other intelligence, had helped us draw a bead on a high-ranking al-Qaeda leader. Then a brave foreign agent recruited by the CIA led us to the door of an apartment complex in Pakistan. "I want my children free of these madmen who distort our religion and kill innocent people," the agent later said. Pakistani forces raided the complex and hauled out their target. It was the chief operating officer of Al-Qaeda, the murderer of Danny Pearl, and the mastermind of 9/11, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. I was relieved to have one of Al-Qaeda's senior leaders off the battlefield. But my relief did not last long. Agents searching Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's compound discovered what one official later called a motherlode of valuable intelligence. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was obviously planning more attacks. It didn't sound like he was willing to give us any information about them. "I'll talk to you," he said, after I get to New York and see my lawyer. George Tenet asked if he had permission to use enhanced interrogation techniques, including waterboarding, on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. I thought about my meeting with Danny Pearl's widow, who was pregnant with his son when he was murdered. I thought about the 2,973 people stolen from their families by Al-Qaeda on 9/11. And I thought about my duty to protect the country from another act of terror. "Damn right," I said. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed proved difficult to break. But when he did, he gave us a lot. He disclosed plans to attack American targets with anthrax and directed us to three people involved in the Al-Qaeda biological weapons program. He provided information that led to the capture of Hambali, the chief of Al-Qaeda's most dangerous affiliate in Southeast Asia, and the architect of the Bali terrorist attack that killed 202 people. He provided further details that led agents to Hambali's brother, who had been grooming operatives to carry out another attack inside the United States, possibly a West Coast version of 9/11, in which terrorists flew a hijacked plane into the Library Tower in Los Angeles. Years later, the Washington Post ran a front-page story about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's transformation, headlined, "How a Detainee Became an Asset." It described how Mohammed seemed to relish the opportunity, sometimes for hours on end, to discuss the inner workings of Al-Qaeda and the group's plans, ideology, and operatives. He'd even use a chalkboard at times. The intelligence he provided, which proved vital to saving American lives, almost certainly would not have come to light without the CIA's enhanced interrogation program. Of the thousands of terrorists we captured in the years after 9/11, about 100 were placed into the CIA program. About a third of those were questioned using enhanced techniques. Three were waterboarded. The information the detainees in the CIA program revealed constituted more than half of what the CIA knew about Al-Qaeda. Their interrogations helped break up plots to attack American military and diplomatic facilities abroad, Heathrow Airport, and Canary Wharf in London, and multiple targets in the United States. Experts in the intelligence community told me that without the CIA program, there would have been another attack on the United States. After we implemented the CIA program, we briefed a small number of lawmakers from both parties on its existence. At the time, some were concerned we weren't pushing hard enough. But years later, once the threat seemed less urgent, and the political winds had shifted, many lawmakers became fierce critics. They charged that Americans had committed unlawful torture. That was not true. I had asked the most senior legal officers in the U.S. government to review the interrogation methods, and they had assured me they did not constitute torture. To suggest that our intelligence personnel violated the law by following the legal guidance they received is insulting and wrong. The CIA interrogation program saved lives. Had we captured more Al-Qaeda operatives with significant intelligence value, I would have used the program for them as well. On the morning of March 10, 2004, Dick Cheney and Andy Card greeted me with a startling announcement. The terrorist surveillance program would expire at the end of the day. "How can it possibly end?" I asked. "It's vital to protecting the country." 2.5 years had passed since I authorized the TSP in October 2001. In that time, the NSA had used the program to uncover key details about terrorist plots and locations. NSA Director Mike Hayden later said publicly that the program had been successful in detecting and preventing attacks inside the United States, and that it was his professional judgment that we would have detected some of the 9/11 Al-Qaeda operatives in the United States if it had been operational before the attacks. Andy explained the situation. While John Ashcroft had regularly recommended the renewal of the TSP since 2001, the Justice Department had raised a legal objection to one component of the program. "Why didn't I know about this?" I asked. Andy shared my disbelief. He told me he had just learned about the objection the previous night. The legal team must have thought the disagreement could be settled without presidential involvement. I told Andy to work with Ashcroft and White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez to solve the problem. In the meantime, I had to fly to Cleveland to deliver a speech on trade policy. When I got back, I checked in with Andy. Little progress had been made. The Justice Department was sticking to its objection. My lawyers weren't budging either. They were convinced the program was legal. "Where the hell is Ashcroft?" I asked. "He's in the hospital," Andy replied. That was news to me. I called John, who I discovered was recovering from emergency gallbladder surgery. I told him I was sending Andy and Al to talk to him about an urgent matter. They drove to the hospital with the TSP reauthorization order. When they got back, they told me Ashcroft hadn't signed. The only way to allow the program to continue was to override the Justice Department's objection. I didn't like the idea, but I saw no other alternative. I signed an order keeping the TSP alive based on my authority as head of the executive branch. I went to bed irritated and had a feeling I didn't know the full story. I intended to get it. "Mr. President, we've got a major problem," Andy told me when I got to the Oval Office on the morning of March 12th. "Jim Comey is the acting attorney general, and he's going to resign because you extended the TSP. So are a bunch of other Justice Department officials." I was stunned. Nobody told me that Comey, John Ashcroft's deputy, had taken over Ashcroft's responsibility when he went in for surgery. If I had known that, I never would have sent Andy and Al to John's hospital room. I asked to speak to Comey privately after the morning FBI briefing, which he attended in John Ashcroft's place. I hadn't spent a lot of time with Jim, but I knew he had a distinguished record as a prosecutor in New York. I started by explaining that I had an obligation to do what was necessary to protect the country. I felt the TSP was essential to that effort. He explained his concerns about the problematic aspect of the program. "I just don't understand why you were raising this at the last minute," I said. He looked shocked. "Mr. President," he said, "your staff has known about this for weeks." Then he dropped another bomb. He wasn't the only one planning to resign. So was FBI Director Bob Mueller. I was about to witness the largest mass resignation in modern presidential history, and we were in the middle of a war. I called Bob into the Oval Office. I'd come to know him well over the past 2.5 years. He was a good and decent man, a former Princeton hockey star who had served in the Marines and led the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco. Without hesitation, he agreed with Comey. "If I continued the program over the Justice Department's objection," he said, "he couldn't serve in my administration." I had to make a big decision, and fast. Some in the White House believed I should stand on my powers under Article 2 of the Constitution and suffer the walkout. Others counseled that I accept Justice's objections, modify the program, and keep the administration intact. I was willing to defend the powers of the presidency under Article 2, but not at any cost. I thought about the Saturday night massacre in October 1973, when President Richard Nixon's firing of Watergate prosecutors